All right. Apologize for being gone last week. We were, as they say, providentially detained. This is lesson two on C.R. Wiley's book, The Household and the War for the Cosmos is my grandson. So this is what it looks like in the flesh. Okay. Short little read. So if you recall, 2 weeks ago, I was talking about the Latin word pietas, or pietas, I guess is how you say it in Latin, and the idea of piety in English, and sort of that's the first big idea that Wiley has. So his notion that we are born in this world with obligations and duty, and that this notion of pietas or piety actually connects us to our Creator, to, in some kind of rough sense, the place that we're born or that we live, and to our family. And so that's about as far as that first kind of argument goes. And so I'm going to talk today. This will also be sort of a preparatory talk. So one of the concerns that I raised 2 weeks ago was this idea of essentially going to classical sources for information about the Bible. Okay, so the idea that, well, the Greek and Roman writers thought this, and that should help us understand the Bible a little bit better. Okay, so there is a long-standing argument in the Christian church that goes back basically to the beginning on this very issue. Okay, so that's what I'm going to sort of start with today. And the North African philosopher from the late 3rd, early 4th century, Tertullian, famously said, "Quid ergo Athenis et Herolosimus," I don't know how to say that in Latin, but basically means, what does Athens have to do with Jerusalem? So he was famously against a strong no vote on the idea that the classical thinkers and writers could have anything to do to really help us with the Christian faith. So that was one camp in the early church, was, hey, these guys were pagans. They didn't know the true and living God. We have the Bible. We don't need them. Okay, so I think all of us at some level have probably resonated with that kind of thinking. We look at the culture, we go, it's pagan as you know what, and what do we want to do with it? We don't want anything to do with it. Okay, and I think that's that sort of reaction. And then about not quite 100 years later, St. Augustine famously said, "Omnis veritas est veritas Dei," all truth is God's truth. Okay, so his argument was that since God is the ultimate source and author of all reality, any genuine truth, whether found in sacred scriptures, nature, or human reason, ultimately derives from and is consistent with him. So St. Augustine has sort of the other view. Now, he's not the first theologian to have the other view. There were many very, very early Christian fathers, you know, first and second century Christian fathers who kind of had the other view, okay, that God had in his wisdom and providence been preparing the world for Christ, okay, and that in this preparation of the world for Christ, he was using his people, although his people were often rebellious and disobedient. So sometimes that using of his people was punishing them. But he's also using, you know, thoroughly pagan rulers, at least, to prepare the way. And then, you know, famously, you know, Paul's sermon in Athens on Mars Hill, you know, he's quoting, you know, pagan poets and philosophers to sort of make his apologetic point to the Athenians. So St. Augustine basically argues that, you know, God's the God of the whole world, and whether people are bending the knee to him or not, he still is arranging history for his purposes. Okay, so the Reformed tradition, well, let me go back even further. Okay, the broad Roman Catholic theological tradition lands on Augustine's side of this argument. The Reformed tradition, minus a little bit of Martin Luther, lands thoroughly on this sort of side of the argument. Okay, now again, I'm not sure at the time of the Reformation they can quite imagine a world that is post-Christian, like our world largely is. But they basically are willing to, the line is, you know, pillage the Egyptians to take the treasures that they've got and bring them into use in the household of faith. So Augustine wins the argument. And so what Wiley is really appealing to is that theological strain. Now, I was not classically educated. Okay, I'm a product of DOD schools and, you know, Okaloosa County Public School. All right, so some of you in here have been classically educated, you know, more young people than old people. So the idea of learning from the ancients was really not a thing in my education. I didn't get that till I went to college, and I realized that, yikes, I don't know anything about, you know, pre-Enlightenment thinking. I wonder what they thought. So the idea that the milieu that I was sort of raised in intellectually was what C.S. Lewis called, you know, this prejudice that anything that comes before our time, you know, people didn't know how to think. And I will just argue that, you know, Johannes Kepler is figuring out, you know, when the next eclipse is going to be in 400 years, you know, with analytic geometry, okay? Dude's way smarter than anybody I know. So the ancient world, the pre-modern world, if you will, is brilliant. And, you know, it's kind of funny because now, basically, when moderns look at the sort of the wonders of the pre-modern age, they basically say, well, it had to be aliens, right? You know, early man could not have possibly done this. They were too stupid and primitive and ignorant. You know, it had to be an advanced civilization from outer space. So it's just dumb, okay? And Lewis skewers it quite well. So if you're interested in a treatment on that question, he handles that really well. But the point is that the ancients actually do have something, I think, to teach us. So, you know, I've worked now for 45 years in a school that, you know, is more classically oriented and teaches kids ancient wisdom. Yes, sir?
Mike, is this a discussion on hermeneutics? Where are we going?
Yeah, well, okay, that's a great question. When you read the book, you can ask the exact same question through about the middle of the book. So this is the second lesson that's going to be like this, because he's establishing some ground rules, and he's doing it in a way that you know, is kind of gently leading the reader to some commitments. So I would say the nuts and the bolts of the theology of the book are coming lesson three and lesson four. But thanks for that question. I'll try to keep meandering. St. Augustine basically says that, you know, all truth is God's truth, and you have to measure things from all sources, Christian and non-Christian, by the word of God, but you don't just throw them out because the author, you know, wasn't a Christian. All right, so now he's going to jump to an argument. And the argument is that when you compare Abraham and Aeneas, there's a lot of similarity there. So I am just finishing teaching the Aeneid in school. Kids have a test this week. And this is something that, you know, when I kind of prepare the kids that we're going to read this book, this is one of the points I bring out, is that early Christians looked at the Aeneid and said, oh, this guy's an Abraham figure. Okay, he's Abraham. And so that's not a new idea. Wiley didn't make the idea up, but he basically wants to explore those similarities. And then he's going to want to look at some differences. So I think the theology will be coming into a little bit clearer focus by the end of the lesson, okay? But you'll have to bear with me. And when you read the book, this is a nuanced argument, okay? So that's one of the reasons it struck me is I'd really never read anybody that had made this kind of argument, and, you know, I'm not the world's leading expert on the Aeneid, but I'm kind of, you know, for a local area, probably the second leading expert, you know, leading expert being sitting right here. So I was interested in the argument, and the theology of it in the second half of the book was, you know, very powerful to me. That argument's very powerful, so you can judge at the end whether you think it was a waste of time or not. All right, so Abraham, Aeneas, and Pietas. Okay, so the idea is that your inner feelings used to be tamed. The goal of life was to tame your inner feelings in order to conform to an external objective reality. Okay, so this goes back to the Truman book about the rise of the modern self and the importance of our feelings. Okay, so we did a whole Sunday school lesson on kind of how we got where we are today. And of course, today we're in this world where inner feelings rule, right? The romantic revolution of the beginning of the 19th century and then the end of the 19th century and then the hippies, you know, they've won, basically. It looks like they've won. Okay, we are driven by our feelings. So, you know, byproducts that, you know, their tagline is, it feels good, do it. Okay, said no person ever in the previous 5,900 years of human experience, but, you know, now that's the motto, right? Okay, so now, even more crazily, the physical world has to conform to my inner feelings. So we're, you know, at this surprising moment, kind of like in the American Revolution, where, you know, George Washington loses, wins, and we win, and we're free, right? Okay, so you have a terrible season, and you win the championship game, and we're kind of in that mode right now with a lot of this Soji stuff. You know, that's sexual orientation and gender identity. That's the legal shortcut for that. So all the Soji stuff is basically seems to be have taken a punch in the nose and, you know, rationality and science and clear thinking seem to be prevailing for the moment, okay? So maybe this is our Yorktown? Maybe we're going to win, okay? But the conference I was just in D.C. basically says, Be prepared for the backlash, okay? And so the backlash, they detail legally how the backlash is probably going to come. And, yeah, it's like we've been, if you've lived here long enough, we've been in the eye of a hurricane before. So you got these fierce winds, and all of a sudden you look up, and it's blue skies, and then it's worse coming the other way, right? That's kind of what they're thinking is getting ready to happen with all this stuff. So this idea that whatever I feel on the inside has got to arrange the external world. It's insanity. That's the definition of insane, right? So, you know, this book has some overlap with the Truman book, but it's basically this idea that Abraham and Aeneas are both driven by a version of this idea of pietas, okay? So we're going to look at them now. All right, so they're both founders, okay? Aeneas is going to found the people that will turn into Rome, and Abraham's going to found the people of God. Well, kind of. Classically, okay, so the classical ideas of order and virtue, okay, which again, this is more of a Roman argument than a Greek, so if you are well-educated classically, you will notice that difference. And then the biblical patterns of household, faith, and culture. Okay, so he's at the beginning, he's contrasting these a little bit. So they're not, he's not saying they're the same guy. Okay? He's saying they're similar, but there are differences in the two cultures. Okay? And he does not want to just sort of say, ah, Aeneas is great. He's basically Abraham. Everything he did was super, you know, duper. He's not saying that. Okay, he is saying, though, that there are a lot of similarities, and we're going to kind of look at those. So Aeneas embodies pietas, and so before I ever read this book, you know, 40 years ago when I started teaching the Aeneid, you know, this is, pious Aeneas is what you call him. That if you have to characterize him in one word, he's pious. Okay. So what does that mean for him? Okay, and he's a different type of hero. In the epic poems of the ancient world, he's different than all the other epic heroes, okay, because of this. So he's loyal to the gods, and it's not that the other epic heroes aren't occasionally loyal to the gods, but that's not their fundamental characteristic. They bend the knee when they have to, when they're forced to, okay? And they basically are trying to outsmart the gods, and like in Odysseus' case, he's flipping off gods, which is a bad idea in the ancient world, apparently. Loyalty to the gods that's heartfelt and real, okay? He is incredibly loyal, respectful, and honoring to his father Anchises, to his household gods, and to the ultimate destiny of Rome. So Aeneas' conflict, if you're not super familiar with the book, is that he's a survivor of the sack of Troy by the Greeks and, you know, the Trojan horse story. So he's escaping with this ragtag bunch of survivors, and they just want to get someplace safe and breathe and start over again. And the problem is he goes to about six places that are perfect stopping places to, and in some cases, other people have gotten there before him and actually built a city. And he keeps saying, no, we have to go on because there's this prophecy that they've got to end up in Tuscany, okay? Because that's where they're going to found Rome. So he has to deny himself over and over again, deny his people what they actually want, which is just let this be over. And he has to go, and waiting for him when he arrives there is a war. Okay, they just fled a war. Now he's running to a war. There's all these peaceful places he can stop. Why would you run to a war? Okay, so he is reluctantly, in many places in the book, obedient to that call. Okay, so he's got a call on him. He's obedient to that. He's a good fighter, but that's not what he primarily is. So, you know, Achilles is the guy that's going to go out before breakfast and kill three guys just to, you know, stay sharp, right? And Aeneas is a guy that believes that war is hell. I mean, that's a big thing in this book. So for the Roman Empire, essentially their Bible, to be a book about war being hell, that's kind of weird, right? Because the Romans were certainly purveyors of conquest and war. But that really is a theme in the book. And then he is always sacrificing what he actually wants. So he has a dalliance with the queen of Carthage named Dido, and, you know, leaves her in the dust. And so that's actually him and Dido, I think, is that artwork right there. And so he's told what he's got to do, and he just keeps doing it. So there's this idea of, I know what I'm supposed to do. I don't really want to do it, but it's the right thing to do, so I'm just going to keep going on, and I'm going to persevere to the end, okay? So that's the some Cliff Notes version of who Aeneas is. So Abraham, we're much more familiar with because we're a church that reads our Bibles. So he's got a different form than this Roman form of pietas, but it's similar. So he leaves Ur with a promise that he's going to get land, right? But he leaves home and family, and, you know, basically spends the bulk of his life in expectation of a promise that he, you know, he gets very late in life. The first little, you know, tiny kernel of the promise he sort of gets at the end of his life. But he is clearly And even the Sunday school song, you know, Father Abraham and many sons. You know, he's clearly carrying the future of a people with him, right? So he's not just obligated to Sarah, okay, and his household servants. He's obligated to, ultimately, people that are not born, and he will never see born because it's a future people. And that's really, you know, time-wise, between Aeneas and the founding of Rome is another 500 or 600 years. It's a long while. So the idea is that, you know, essentially, you know, and this is how the Bible says it, you know, he's carrying Jesus in a way in his loins. Okay, he's carrying a people in his loins. Okay, and that promised seed is going to be who all this is for. Now, you know, Roman Empire, glorious while it lasted. You know, if you've been to modern day Italy or examined their military and political history for the last several hundred years, they ain't all that much right now. Okay, the people of God, on the other hand, have, you know, started as a couple, and, you know, now are millions and millions and millions. I mean, roughly almost half of the people on earth alive today name the name of Christ. Okay, so that ain't bad, okay, as far as having a people that you're the father of. The key difference that Wiley brings out, which is, I think, something we would appreciate, is that his piety, Abraham's piety, is really covenantal more than civic, right? So Abraham's city is his extended household, which has got enough guys to go fight a war, right? At least a minor war with the five kings. But, you know, he's not New York City, right? He's not New Jersey. He's not, you know, France. He's a big, giant camp of people with livestock and, you know, slaves and servants. And obedience is clearly there with Abraham. Trust in God. And then a household faithfulness. And the household faithfulness in the Abrahamic story is really central. Okay, because you think about Hagar and Ishmael, and you think about all of the stuff going on, you know, and even the story of him taking Isaac up to the top of the mountain. Okay, all of this is household faithfulness stuff. Okay, yes, sir.
So Abraham was good to his household, right?
Yep.
You wanted to be a member of his household. Would you say the same thing about him?
Well, okay, so all epic heroes, this is a rule for you readers of epic literature, all epic heroes, the worst person to be in an epic is the best friend of the hero. Okay, you're a dead man walking. Okay, so family, in Aeneas' case, you don't want to be his wife or girlfriend. Okay, that's a death sentence. Not in the same way. Very, very much not in the same way. Point. So, Aeneas, Abraham, they've got some of the same kinds of things going on. Okay? So, Aeneas is kind of, you know, thinking about this in comparison. The pietas is duty to family, God's, and Rome's future. For Abraham, pietas is faith in the living God and stewardship of that promise, and then his household, who, you know, all of these people matter, right? Eleazar, the Damascusite, matters, okay? These people all matter to him, and he is invested in caring for them. So, Wiley's argument here, I'm not sure how strong I think it is, but he's arguing that the household is the vessel of continuity through children, inheritance, and sort of their memory. Okay, so in the Aeneid, Aeneas is going to get to Italy and marry his final wife, Lavinia. And it's really Iulus, his son from Troy, that the line is going to come through. So he's going to get married to this girl, this Italian girl, and establish this thing that's going to eventually become Rome. But it's not that marriage that produces the child that's going to be the ancestor. It's his son from Troy. So that's a key difference. And so that's a place where, again, I get what Wiley's doing, but that's a difference. So the household in Abraham's case, okay, we are, what is it, four chapters? It's not Hagar and Ishmael. Okay, it is Sarah and Isaac. And all of the detail that goes into them being too old, her laughing, coming back in a year, the sacrifice, the taking him up on the top of the mountain, all of those details are just pounding it home that it's this couple and this kid are the key, right? So you can't get to Joseph, you know, without going through Jacob and Isaac. And so the key to the story is really the household, I believe, in Genesis. And the Aeneid, I'm a little squishier that he makes the argument that well. Okay, I mean, I think in general he's right, but I think that there are important differences there. So I just, again, I wouldn't take this too far, if that makes sense. Yes, ma'am.
Is it possible that the reason there's such a similarity is that Virgil, spelled with an E-R, but the church changes it to an I-R because he probably read the Old Testament?
Yeah, I think he certainly read the Old Testament.
And so, you know, maybe he just borrowed
it. He was an egghead. You gotta remember, in the ancient world, you know, it's not like libraries today where you walk in and, you know, there's more books than you can read in there's more books at Eric Storr's house than you could read in a lifetime.
He did borrow the Virgin Birth in one of his other books.
So I think that in the ancient world there's just not that many books. You know, you can read all the books that are written. And so Virgil was an incredible egghead. I think he probably had access to every book that was in Rome because he's Augustus's best friend. I think he read everything there was. So I think he certainly read the Old Testament. So anyhow, I don't want to waste too much time on this, but again, I think the argument's fine, but, you know, if you push too far, maybe not. All right, so the duty aspect of pietas. So what he wants to argue with this is that in both cases, so now he's broadening this to the idea of civilization, okay, that there are two things that are driving carrying civilization forward. So again, back to the Truman book, you know, we're looking at a point in history where we have a breakdown of civilization. Okay, so Wiley's arguing this is what's needed to restore civilization, carry civilization forward. And that's your obligation to people on the horizontal plane, and it's your obligation to God on the vertical or transcendent plane. Okay, so two great commandments, love the Lord your God, love your neighbor. He's arguing that this cross-shaped thing that is the two great commandments is what really is going to carry a civilization forward. Okay, so in other words, you know, can I make the argument that the reason that I didn't have to bribe some neighborhood kid to watch my truck while I came in here for 3 hours, so that, you know, when Troy went to Mozambique, what he had to do there, so that my wheels and my battery aren't gone when I come back out, okay, is because there is still a remnant of a civilization in Valpee, Florida, where our property, while not universally safe, is relatively safe. Okay? The fact that I got rear-ended by a drunk driver for the first time in my life, okay, and it being an unusual circumstance where somebody else's, you know, reckless, negligent, you know, antisocial behavior, you know, has negatively impacted me and my wife, that's a rarity in my life, means that some vestiges of civilization still remain, right? So what he's arguing is that for the things that we enjoy and kind of I take for granted, at least, in life, those things are delivered to us by people that went before us who love God and love their neighbor. So if that's what he's selling, I'm buying. Okay, I believe that to be true. And I believe that if you look at places where, you know, you're bribing somebody to guard your truck and your house is getting get broken into, and, you know, my friends that do Christian school in Haiti are hiring guys with, you know, automatic weapons to stand in their courtyard 24 hours a day, okay, so their kids don't get kidnapped, that, you know, the breakdown is they don't love God and they don't love their neighbor. Okay? I think that's a clear argument. And that's really what he's trying to argue here, I think. So, pietas is not some kind of, you know, ooey-gooey sentimental attachment, but it's really, it's the stewardship of a sacred trust. Okay, so you and I, in this argument, are stewards of a sacred trust. Whether we're married with 100 kids, like my oldest son, or we're single and a cat lady, okay? We're stewards of a sacred trust because we're obliged to love God and to love our neighbor, and that means that we're going to make some sacrifices at different points for people that are not yet born. And we may never know, and we may not be related to. Okay, so it's pretty normally easy to get motivated for, you know, we haven't had a baby in here. Where's our baby? Okay, so when you're holding that little baby, it isn't too terribly difficult to get motivated to sacrifice a lot for that little baby, right? Now, when they turn into teenagers, sometimes a little bit more complicated. The feelings aren't always there. But the point is that usually the natural affection motivation for our own family is strong enough to make us do things that we, you know, aren't fun for us to sacrifice for the good of our families.
So I get that with Abraham. And he has had self-sacrifice in mind for his family?
In that his dad would have probably lived longer if he wasn't dragging him all over the Mediterranean. He's obviously risking his own life and the life of his only son, surviving family member, his son, to go to Italy because, you know, Ulysses has to fight, and he's a teenage kid. Dido's a capable, attractive woman who's in charge of North Africa. He could have just stayed there and lived out his days. I think that he's sacrificing comfort, peace, security, safety, predictability to go fight Turnus in Italy.
But was that for self-aggrandizement?
No, because he's never... It's clear that he's not going to gain anything by going to Italy personally. He's not going to be the king of anything. Okay? You know, it's 500 years down the line. So the notion that we're going to sacrifice for our families isn't that hard. Sacrificing for our neighbors, okay? We all know people like that. Some of us are people like that. I'm not particularly a person like that. I'm not quite that noble. But we know people that will work a full-time, you know, unpaid job for civic organizations, neighborhoods, you know, charitable organizations. You know, and obviously we're going to do a lot for our church family. Okay, so that's just, that's kind of built into being a Christian. But we all know people that are civically minded in that kind of service way. So, you know, feeling an obligation to your neighbors. In our circumstances, many in here have served in the military. So the idea of serving your country is very, very strong in our area. And so, you know, I would say that probably, arguably, more people in our circles would be motivated for the U.S. of A. than for the state of Florida or even Okaloosa County, because that's really, you know, very, very high virtue in our community. Okay? And I think that comes from the military. So people that are nationally minded is a big. So just thinking about loving God, loving neighbor, and then what that costs you is kind of the idea there. So now, sort of the last idea that I want to talk about is leading up to sort of the meat and potatoes of the book, which is that these two ideas, the Aeneas and Abraham ideas, although similar, and he's going to want to use that Roman idea of pietas to establish some meaning in New Testament language, that really these two ideals are actually on a collision course. Okay? So, you know, he performs a little bit of a sleight of hand here by, you know, talking about Tertullian and dismissing him, citing St. Augustine, and, you know, using these guys that, you know, they're basically sort of first cousins, they're brothers from another mother. And then at the end he says, but really, you know, the claims of Jehovah God and Christ are very, 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 very different than the claims of Augustus Caesar. And by the time we get to the first century AD, we see those conflicting claims sort of like this. Okay, now, this argument's going to matter for the next section, but basically the idea here is that Jesus or Caesar, you got to choose. Okay, and first century Christians were existentially thrust into that choice. And so all of the persecutions until, you know, Constantine basically officializes Christianity, all those persecutions were people like us who were citizens and Christians having to choose between those two conflicting loyalties. Now, there are certainly times in American history, I'd argue that most of the last, you know, 20 years, you know, as a Christian, you kind of feel that tug, right? Okay, this is the way that the country seems to be going. Those don't seem to be very godly, biblical values. My allegiance is to Christ. But at the same time, you know, I've spent a lifetime in the sworn service of our country to defend the Constitution. And so we're in this bind, right, as American Christians, of, you know, feeling the tug of those two different loyalties. Many of us in this room, you know, derive our livelihood from, if not directly from the United States government, then from contracts paid to private vendors from the United States government. So, you know, we're in a way, we're kind of in a company town, right? The company is the United States government. Or the DOD. Is it still DOD? DOW? Okay. So the problem, we can kind of identify with this problem, is that there are times that being a Christian seems to mean that I'm not going to do exactly what is expected of me from government. Okay, so again, that's a bind that we, I think, probably feel at times. But it's certainly one that in the first century and beyond for Christians was, you know, very, very, very existentially real. So, you know, you either pinch the incense to Caesar or you get fed to the animals, right? And so, you know, who's Lord? Is Caesar Lord or is Jesus Lord? Now, biblically, there's no argument, right? Okay. And lots of Christians would say Jesus is Lord, and whatever it cost him, it cost him. Okay, so, but Wiley is arguing that, you know, while these two ideas are parallel in many ways, they're ultimately in conflict because you can't have two supreme beings. And so the Romans really believed, and I talked about this 2 weeks ago, that as they conducted war, they were doing the will of the gods. Okay, so in other words, every Roman war was a holy war because the gods had established them to carry these virtues into the barbarian lands. And so, much like Napoleon, when he's exporting the French Revolution across Europe and into North Africa, you know, he's exporting the values of the French Revolution, which are religious values, okay, to these other places, many of whom were fairly Christian, okay, and French Revolution is decidedly anti-Christian, okay, even though Napoleon, you know, incorporated the church for his own purposes. So if you think of, you know, modern jihadis, okay, that they're waging religious war, right? Okay, now in America, we're kind of proud of the fact that we don't do that. But I would say that, you know, much of our foreign policy for the last 100-something years has been, you know, kind of the Woodrow Wilson, Jimmy Carter exporting American liberal ideals of self-government to the rest of the world that don't have it, okay? And you can kind of see places that it sticks and places that it hasn't stuck. And it's Korea is, to me, an interesting case study because, you know, we came in and saved South Korea, right? And so they adopted, essentially as a nation, the religion of their saviors. You know, we saved them, and they said, well, who's your God? Jesus? Okay, he'll, you know, so I'm not saying every South Korean is a Christian, but, you know, a lot of them are. Okay? Japan, we conquered them. They're not interested, really, in the religion of their saviors, are they? So we have missionaries to Japan where, what is it, 1.2% is Christian. So, you know, the idea of religion and war seems like a medieval concept to us, but it really is kind of true. I mean, warfare, you know, if you're being asked to go die for some ideal, you know, that's got a religious dimension to it. So even in a largely secular nation like we've become, there's a religious dimension. And so, you know, it's a vacuum. If it's not the Lord God in heaven, it'll be something else. Okay? So I think that the Romans clearly thought they were doing this because they had a divine mandate to do. We certainly think that we're in a war, okay? And he's going to spend a lot of time in Ephesians in the second half of the book. So yeah, that whole armor of God passage, which is our theme this year, it's kind of our founding verse, but it's our theme at school this year. That whole armor of God passage, you know, you're a soldier. I'm a soldier, okay? You're in a war. Yes, sir.
So theologically, we would tend to agree that they did have the divine mandate based off of the prophecy that Daniel provides.
Like the Babylonians did and the Assyrians did. And
up to a point.
Yeah.
Until the rock that had not been cut by human hands rolls them up.
So Wiley doesn't there's a whole argument theologically on this sort of oikoumene period. Jim Jordan is the first guy I've ever heard really talk about it. But what God's doing with the rise of all of these ancient kingdoms is he's building the world to be ready for coming of Christ. And it's sort of like the statue in Daniel's vision. Okay, so that's what God's doing in this sort of broad into the Old Testament to the beginning of the New Testament time period is he's doing all this work. So yeah, and that's clearly a divine mandate. Now, the Assyrians are not faithful to, other than that brief window when Nineveh gets converted entirely, they're not really being consciously faithful to the Lord God in heaven. Okay, but they are doing what he wants them to do. Okay, so, so you would argue that. So, the thing I'm going to stop with today is that in St. Augustine's City of God, you basically have this argument that Wiley's making. Okay, you have this idea that there's two cities, the city of man and the city of God, and the city of man is informed by all the wrong pagan thinking, okay, and the city of God is informed by faithfulness to Jesus and to his work, and that the city of God is going to triumph over the city of man, but you're going to see them running parallel for a long time, okay, till the ultimate triumph of the city of God. Both are going to be around, and they're going to be in conflict, right? Okay, and that rather than thinking that the city of God is going to be, you know, Valparaiso, Florida, or the United States of America, or North America, or medieval France, okay, they're always going to be intermingled. So it's like the wheat and the tares. Okay, they're always going to be in the same geographical location until Christ comes back. So what we should be doing is we should be living mindful of the fact that we're in the city of God and building that city, while at the same time, you know, like the people building the wall in Nehemiah's Jerusalem, you know, you got a trowel in one hand and a sword in the other. You're working to build up, and at the same time, you got eyes in the back of your head because you know you might have to fight at any minute. Okay, and that really characterizes the world that we live in. The good news is we know who wins, right? So we should work in confidence and hope. The quote-unquote bad news is that we don't know when that's exactly going to be. And, you know, kind of like George Washington, that we may lose some battles on the way and lose some soldiers on the way to get there. Okay, so martyrdom will not be erased before final victory. Yes, Mike?
Is Wiley going to address syncretism?
Not a lot.
Which is a problem.
Yeah, all of us are syncretic. Yeah, all of us.
And the pagans are too.
Yeah.
And they're not living consistently
right
with their world.
No, he doesn't really. I mean, I can imagine how he would, you know, I think our job is to, you know, semper reformanda, you know, always be reforming. Okay? So, in other words, be in your word and always be looking for things that have grown up that need to be cut back. Okay. Any other questions? That was a good question. All right. Well, Mike, why don't you pray for us?
Well, Father, we ask that you would help us to better understand.